Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. We've combed through our archives to bring you what we believe represents the very best our show has to offer. Tonight, we bring you three extraordinary talents. Actor Jeff Goldblum appeared on our Paul Schrader tribute show to speak about his collaboration with Schrader on the great film Adam Resurrected. Legendary character actor Alan Rickman is a tremendous favorite among audiences for great work in movies like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Dogma, and Die Hard. He came on to discuss a movie he did in 2009 titled Nobel Son. And finally, Rutger Hauer. You know him from a series of highly influential films from Blade Runner to Batman Begins. It's all documented in his autobiography titled All Those Moments. Mr. Hauer joined us to discuss the contents of that autobiography. But first up tonight, Jeff Goldblum. The Movie Geeks are honored to welcome to our program one of our great artists, an actor whose tremendously versatile roster of performances in film, stage, and television never fail to inspire, move, or surprise us. His extensive credits include searing performances in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, The Big Chill, Silverado, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Igby Goes Down, The Life Aquatic, Faye Grimm, and of course, David Cronenberg's The Fly, in which he delivered a one-of-a-kind performance, beautifully modulated between the horrifying and the heartbreaking. His barely contained enthusiasm for the art of acting is always apparent and deeply infectious, as it was with my favorite film of last year, The Delightful Pittsburgh. But he is also never fearful of tackling a role that takes him to the darkest realms of humanity. His latest work in Paul Schrader's Adam Resurrected certainly sounds like such an exploration. It is a great delight that I introduce to the show one of our greatest actors and one of our greatest inspirations, Mr. Jeff Goldblum. Mr. Goldblum,
hello.
Jamie,
hi, how are you? Thank you so much. You're too kind. That's very, very sweet of you.
Well, thank you so much. I want to start out, I want to do the slobbering fan thing right off the bat, because we speak for hours on end every week on the show about our love of cinema, and you keep coming back up, and particularly with your work in The Fly. I just think it is one of the most astonishing performances I've ever witnessed.
Thank you so much. Well, it was fun and challenging to do, and David Cronenberg, of course, is largely responsible. He's a wonderful director and a great fellow. Have you ever talked to him?
Not yet. We actually had the honor of speaking with Howard Shore, and he's mounting the opera for The Fly right now.
Oh yeah, I've heard rumors about that. What are they? They're doing an opera of it, huh?
I think they're probably pretty close to premiere time on that.
How about that?
I know it's amazing, and I also have to tell you that I got a chance to see Pittsburgh last year, like I said in the intro. It is the most delightful movie I think I've ever seen. I was grinning ear to ear from start to finish.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. Well, it's special to me. You know, we cooked it up over several years, you know, even though it's a very modest little handcrafted thing, and I got a big kick out of it myself.
Yeah. Well, I promise no more oogly, slobbering fan stuff from here on out. I got that out of the way.
Thank you, you're
calling us all the way from London. I appreciate it so much. You're in the middle of a run of David Mamet's Speed the Plow at the Old Vic with Kevin Spacey. That sounds like a dream.
It's a dream project. It's really fun. Do you know this play, Speed the Plow?
I know it, kind of. I'm very familiar with Mamet, but not particularly this play.
Yeah, it's about a couple of, you know, Hollywood business types, you know, movie makers in the late 80s, you know, a head of a studio and a producer, who gets exposed to spiritual wisdom material through an encounter with this girl over the course of a night, and thinks his whole life has changed, but we see in the end that there are two guys on the far reaches of idiocy and egotism and materialism, and it doesn't exactly take, at least not yet.
I think that you've been doing this since live performances since early February, and you're running till the end of April. Do you find, given this caliber of writing and the caliber of talent you're acting across from, do you find that you're still discovering things constantly?
Yeah, totally. It's like a continuing workshop and graduate project and rehearsal period. And we fill the theater every night. 1,000 people watch us as we keep exploring this stuff. It's very rich and interesting material. To me, it is, and I keep trying to get better.
I can't imagine how great this show is. So the real reason why you're here to help us pay tribute to Mr. Paul Schrader.
I sure am. I adore him.
And you had the pleasure of working with him on his upcoming film, Adam Resurrected. But before this collaboration came about, were there works of his that you were particularly taken by?
Yes. He was a writer on Raging Bull, of course, as we know, and Taxi Driver and Last Temptation of Christ. And I loved all of those. And then saw all of his movies that he'd done. I loved Affliction, you know, in recent years. Autofocus I really liked. He's just done, his whole body of work is so impressive. He's just always adventurous, risky, and smart, and obviously high integrity.
I think that's what I respond to most with him, because he's not afraid of going to the darkest places.
Yeah.
And he doesn't shy away from ambiguity, and he's fearless. He's one of our true fearless artists.
I think so too. He's an inspiration to me. I think he really is an artist and very brave. And this material was, I think, very challenging and delicious, but a kind of a high wire attempt. And it needed all of his interest in things dark and ambiguous, like you say.
So I think he pulled it off.
I really enjoyed it.
Did he approach you with this project? How did that come about?
Yeah, he did. You know, there's a producer, Israeli producer, and it was co-produced with some German producers. But this Israeli fella, Ehud Blyberg, it had been a passion for him for a couple of decades, taken from a book by Yoram Kaniuk called Adam Resurrected. And he'd been trying to get the rights and gone through many little dramas about it over the years, and had finally latched onto Paul Schrader. And Paul read it and apparently told him that he thought I was the one to play the part. And so they approached me. That's right.
Well, you have said that it's the most challenging and the juiciest part you've ever had on film. Could you tell our audience a little bit more about the plot of the film and the character you play in it?
Sure. It takes place in Israel in 1961-62, roughly, in a mental institution, rehabilitation center, that employs innovative therapies of one kind or another, exclusively for concentration camp survivors. Now that we've been finished with the war for, 15, 16 years since 45. And so we're all there, and we meet me there, and through some flashbacks find out that I was a kind of a star entertainer in Berlin early on, Jewish, and I had a couple of daughters and a wife. I did animal impersonations, and I was a gifted mind reader and a terrific violinist and kind of a big star in Berlin. And Willem Dafoe comes to one of my shows we see back in the 30s, and he's a kind of a sad, crazy character. And I do some mind reading and figure out that he's going to kill himself that very night. And through kind of including him in this bit, I expose it, but kind of laugh him out of it and kind of save his life. Years later, it turns out when we show up at this extermination camp, when we get off the train, he says, "Oh, Adam Stein, you're the funniest man in all of Germany. You should have seen him. He could do any kind of animal there. Here, for my dog Rex here, do an animal impersonation. Do a dog." So I get down on my hands and knees in order to, you know, leverage the safety of my family, and do a dog. And he laughs. He says, "That's funny." He says, "Take him to my barracks," and he makes me be a dog, living in the dog pen and eating from the dog bowl and living in outside and living in the doghouse with his dog for the remaining year and a half that I'm there. I lose my family, as it turns out, and the camp gets liberated, but by that time I'm in a horrible mess, and I've lost my mind. So when I find my way years later to Israel and to this mental institution, one of the things I tell them is they could never have dogs there. That's one thing I can't stand to be around. I can't stand to. And then I hear a dog barking from a room, and it turns out as I make my way over there that it's a 12-year-old boy who's feral, who's been raised by dogs or something, we think, and can only act like a dog. He can only bark. He can't speak. He can't stand on 2 feet, and nobody can help him. And through the course of the movie, even though he brings out horrible recovered memories in me and horrible associations, I reach out to him and he to me, and we kind of heal each other. It ends up in a climax in the middle of the desert and near the Dead Sea in the Negev desert, and I have kind of a spiritual healing epiphany there.
You know, my heart's breaking just your description of the film.
Yeah, it's something. It was really something. And Derek Jacobi's in it. Sir Derek Jacobi is the head of the hospital,
incredible international cast. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, and some great Israeli actors, Ayelet Sharer, and it's great.
It's very dark material, though. Did you have any trepidation about living in that place in yourself for so many months?
Yes. It was at times grim, but finally very educational and uplifting and inspiring. But I had about a year to prepare for it. So I went to Israel for the first time. I'd never been there before. I met Paul Schrader there. We went over the script at one point and spent a couple of days there. And then I went to some concentration camps in Poland and Germany, spent a month in Germany and talked to survivors in Los Angeles and Israel and Europe, and saw many, studied as much as I could in the course of a year. There are people who spend a whole lifetime studying the events of that time and only scratch the surface, but I got what I could in that year, and it was amazing.
That's a real gift, a year of preparation for something like that. But
yeah,
working with Schrader, you're working with he's a brutally honest and kind of uncompromising artist, so I can't imagine what you're expecting before you met him, but when you finally did and started this collaboration, how did he surprise you? What surprised you about him?
Oh, he was spectacular. Well, early on, as I've done with some directors, but I knew that he and I had to closely collaborate on this and really kind of make this thing together. I said, are there any movies that I should see that I've missed? Because I'm always, there are many movies that I've missed. And he sat down, and we were in a restaurant in Israel, actually, and he wrote out on a napkin 20 movies. And I went about, when I got back to the States, and got them, many of them on Criterion, and looked at all of them and all the extra materials, so really took kind of a little course. And that was fantastic. Then, of course, I realized that he was early on with Pauline Kael, and a very serious and respected, spectacular authority on the history of cinema, and I read Schrader on Schrader, which I recommend if you haven't read it to anybody. It's terrific. And so I saw these movies, some of which he said the number one movie was Rules of the Game, which I'd never seen, believe it or not. And then Tokyo Story was the second one by Ozu. A lot of film people, a lot of people know that and like it. He said a couple of movies that he sees before he makes any movie is A Performance, which I'd seen but hadn't in a long time, and The Conformist by Bertolucci. Hadn't seen that in a long time, so I saw those. Vertigo is his favorite Hitchcock movie.
I know he's crazy about Bresson, too, the Pickpocket, I think.
I saw Pickpocket. He said that movie was what made him do movies. Every movie is about a man alone in his room in a way that he's done, Taxi Driver and all those movies.
Wow.
So I saw that. Masculine Feminine is his favorite Jean-Luc Godard movie that he recommended. L'Eclisa is an Antonioni movie that I enjoyed. No, and Seven Men from Now is by Bud Bedeker, and he talks about it in Schrader on Schrader. He was kind of a B-Western director that a lot of people like. Very interesting. And then Fassbinder, Ali Fear Eats the Soul, was a fascinating movie. So anyway, I saw those and many more. He's just so smart. It was just great to be with him, but always surprising, too, passionate about, and we could talk with a lot of fun about American football and American politics. He's just great to talk to, and at times he's mysterious and inscrutable and very focused and direct, and sometimes you don't feel like you can really talk like sometimes I like to do around something and at length about something. You have to really kind of get to the point and cut to the meat of what you're talking. But then at other times he'd be wildly open and personal and accessible and just great to be around. And when he laughs, he's a very serious and imposing fella. Sometimes you'll just be with him in a car and he'll be thinking, and you just have to kind of be quiet and sort of live in this sort of changed air and atmosphere of seriousness and serious focused vibration, but at other times he laughs, he likes to have fun, and when he laughs his eyes crinkle up in a sort of a squinty almost innocent childlike way, and he comes out with a full bodied unbridled laugh that is absolutely delightful and infectious.
So I was wondering that what his style of directing was, because you've worked with some of the best. I mean, you've worked with Woody Allen and Spielberg and Altman and Cronenberg and on. What makes his style of direction unique?
Well, he's great. His story sense, in my humble opinion, I just have this little experience with him, but he knows movies so well. He knows his taste is so refined. He's so sophisticated. He knows what he wants. He's decisive. He's not intrusive in the acting, but he'll tell you just the thing you need to. I came to trust him to terrifically, and he would tell me just the thing that I needed to, make it better. He'd be very good, but then he's got a passion and an endurance kind of willpower during the course of this movie. It's a very difficult thing to make a movie, but this was particularly difficult, I think, in a lot of ways, and it was his singular will and to keep going and to every day kind of fight things out and to make up the shot and figure out what the best shot was, and all through editing, I saw him, and because we did a lot of post-production stuff. There was like a week of ADR and looping. It's just very impressive, his determination, his stick-to-itiveness, and his will to make a movie when, sometimes the crew is not speaking English and other people are, here and there. It's sort of one person is sort of leading this charge and making this movie, and it's conspicuously him. He's just great.
And for this role to be one of the great challenges that you've ever tackled, I hear actors speak of enjoying epiphanies in the creative process and finding moments of transcendence and that being the ultimate reward. What kind of rewards did you get from playing this character, and how does Schrader help to facilitate those?
Well, my gosh, he turned me on to not only a world of cinema that was an enhancement and expansion for me, but on this subject, he had books on German circus things and it gave me material, and just the way, just his, thirst for truthfulness,
yeah,
and depth and authenticity sort of infected me, and while doing a part like this, it really enlarged, I think, my experience of the whole thing. And he's amazing. He's a kind of surprising mix of a lot of things. He seems in some ways to be a very kind of man's man, kind of Hemingway like almost kind of virile, kind of two-fisted kind of a guy, but he's so refined and intuitive and receptive and artful, that when sometimes you'd watch him planning out shots and sort of devising the movement of the camera, and he would become like a dance master. He's kind of almost balletic, and in the way he moves and his sensibility. It's a very interesting mix. Sometimes he'd, you know, in a rehearsal room, just lie down on his stomach on the floor and look at the script and be in a very kind of unexpected, you know, way. He's just spectacular.
Oh, wow. You've seen the cut of the film. What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I think it's really something. I've seen a cut of the locked film, and I have yet to see all the final sound mix put in,
right.
And the music, which is going to be great. I saw the temp mix, but in a way, I've seen this movie more than any movie that I've ever made, because usually I'm curious and I see a movie after it's finished, and then I kind of put it on my shelf and never watch it again. Even when I happen to buy it on TV, I kind of flick by it. I don't know why.
Right.
But this movie, because I knew I was going to do the ADR, the extensive ADR stuff, there's narration that I do in it, I asked them for a cut of the movie a month or two before I did that, like I did in rehearsal. I'm nothing if not conscientious. I'd sort of rehearse the movie every day for a year and do many things, kind of immerse myself in it. But when I had this cut, I'd watch it every day, in fact, which finally helped. But I got to know it and admire it in a lot of ways, in different ways than I ever had. And then seeing him refine the final 11th hour decisions of the cut, I was just, you know, I got very involved in my thinking and feeling about it, and impressed by him. I think it's amazing. I like it a lot. Who knows what impact it'll have on whom, but it's a very serious, unexpected, unique kind of movie.
Do you know if they have a release planned for it yet? A release?
I don't know that all that's been planned yet. I think that's all in the works.
Okay.
But he's very entertaining to be around. He's got, he's been doing it for a while, and so he's got he's a great raconteur. He's a great storyteller, and he's got great show business stories with everybody who he knows, you know, that are interesting.
We cannot wait to welcome him on the show. And Mr. Goldblum, thank you so much. We love you on the show, and we respond so much to your passion for what you do.
Oh,
please come back to us whenever you'd like. You have an open invitation to come.
Anytime you want, Jamie. It's been a pleasure to do it.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. Bye, sir.
Bursting onto the big screen in pictures like Anthony Minghella's Truly, Madly, Deeply, McTiernan's Die Hard, and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, he's continued to produce wildly charismatic and diverse characters in films like Galaxy Quest, Dogma, Love Actually, Sense and Sensibility, and the Harry Potter films. This fall, you can catch him in two films from one of the most exciting new directors, Randall Miller, as Rickman plays the comically arrogant Nobel Prize-winning professor Eli Michelson in Nobel's Son, which is out this Friday, and the snooty wine connoisseur Stephen Spurrier in Bottle Shock, which enjoyed a successful release a couple of months ago. In this interview, we discuss his collaboration with Mr. Miller, his feelings on taking on directing duties himself, and his future creative endeavors, particularly his role in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. Here it is, guys. Enjoy it. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have the opportunity to speak to you, and I did speak to Mr. Miller a couple of months ago in connection to this film and Bottle Shock.
Okay.
And he's obviously crazy about you, and I'm wondering what attracts you to the idea of working with him.
Because you read the scripts and they don't obey any rules, whatever so-called rules of writing are supposed to be, and his movies resist any labels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, always attractive to an actor, because you know you're only as good as the writing. That much I've learned.
Yeah.
And your imagination won't kick in unless something kicks it. So it's kind of a no-brainer to me. You know, it's like a holiday in a way, or a playground. And, you know, you know something must be right because these great actors are there to work with.
Yeah, yeah. And it is like its own sort of rep company. I mean, you're working with people that you worked with on the previous project with Mr. Miller. And
yeah.
I'm wondering what that does, how that affects the experience of shooting these films.
I think it means that there are all sorts of shortcuts. It doesn't make things necessarily simpler or easier because, you know, you're talking about actors who are very challenging to work with, and so it should be. You know, you want to work, and it's not like a career move or a soft option. It's just the way actors would like it to be. There's a proper marketplace. It means maybe there are shortcuts in terms of, you know, the absence, the usual absence on a film set of rehearsal. It means you have a kind of shorthand dialogue, which in some ways maybe takes the place of rehearsal.
Sure.
You can just try things. It's more improvisational. There's a lot of trust around.
Right.
I think that actually that would be the most important thing.
Yeah. What amazes me is how different these two movies are, too. Nobel's
Yeah.
Very frenetic.
Totally different rhythms and totally different look and totally different kind of atmosphere and energy to them.
Yeah. And you're playing a real kind of flamboyantly egotistical character in this. And you're just terrific in it. And when you read it on the page, did you have an idea right away how you would approach this guy?
Well, I really didn't have a clue, and I got on the plane with not much of a clue either, because the last thing you should probably ever do as an actor is judge your character. Mm-hmm. So it was a question of finding some way to play him without judging him. I always rely on fairly basic instincts, and some instinct made me go to my dentist in London and say, I need you to make me some imperfect front teeth. Because I thought there was something sort of shark-like about his appetites.
Right.
And I needed to feel different and look in the mirror and look different. I thought that would be at least a start to something. And it helped a lot, you know, whether you notice it or not watching the film. I've got these two front teeth that kind of just wrap over each other rather than, you know, being a victim of the great American dentist.
Do you do that often? Do you use kind of external forces to inform kind of the internal life of the character?
Well, not that often. Although, you know, the costume is very important to me, and usually that's a slow process, and there's always a discussion with the costume designer, and you know, some characters care about the way they look, and others don't, and you know, sometimes I'm happy to totally hand it over. If you're playing somebody who makes no choices about what they wear, you know, the palette is full of different elements. I guess it just depends. In this case, it was an instinct that I obeyed, and it helped. But I don't usually go for strong. I'm stuck with who I am, basically. So are you.
Right. Right. And I noticed that there seems to be, maybe I'm incorrect, but this misconception that you don't delve into comedy that often. But, in fact, your resume is populated with comical performances.
Yeah, I mean, I always think laughter is available. It may not be a joke. It may not be a gag, but the laughter of recognition by an audience, I think, is there, whatever you do. You know, I got quite a lot of laughs when I played Hamlet.
Yeah, yeah. And is that particularly freeing to play a character like this? And is there any danger of taking it too far?
There's always that danger, and that's where you need the director.
Mm-hmm.
Less, you know, is a very useful and quick word for a director to utter.
Right. I had, once we announced that your presence on the show, we were inundated with listener questions. There's a lot of love for you out there. So
thank
I know
you.
We have limited time, so let me get a couple of these off before we have to part. Anne wants to know. I think Anne is from Germany. She's really curious about your directing project. I think it's a movie called The House in Paris and where you are with that.
Well, I now know that I don't shoot the last Harry Potter until the end of next year. So, although it starts shooting at the beginning of next year. And so, therefore, there is space. And so, with the stars aligning and all the rest of the finagling that goes to making an independent movie, with luck, we will shoot it next year.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
That's the aim.
Yeah. Have you directed, you've directed stage as well?
I just finished directing a play in London at the Donmar Warehouse called Creditors by Strindberg, and that also is due to hopefully have another life in New York next year.
Is there something about directing that kind of completes you in a way that that acting alone doesn't, or is it just a natural extension for you?
It's become a very, very different animal. I think it's you know, because I trained at art school and was a graphic designer, it's like pulling all of the elements together. It's not that I prefer one or the other, but it just feels that one's got to a point now where there are certain things about telling a story that you want to hand on, and that the whole business is a bit of a relay race, and you know, at certain times you find yourself holding a baton,
mm-hmm.
and the job is to pass it on.
Mm.
So it's a question then of finding a story that has images jumping off the page that you don't want to act in necessarily, but you would like to talk to a DP about.
Right, right. And John wants to know about you mentioned your shooting schedule with Harry Potter, but you're also involved in Burton's Alice in Wonderland as well.
Yeah.
Have you already started shooting on that? And tell me about that.
Well, I started. It's a complicated process because some of it's live action, some of it's animation, and some of it's stop motion. And I'm playing the caterpillar, which is animated, but it's my face. So I've done a bit of early work on it where they shot me speaking the lines so that they've got something to work with, and then they'll go away and spend the next year putting the whole movie together, and then I guess I'll go and record it all again.
Mm.
So,
that
you
is,
know.
Yeah. That is interesting when technology evolves like it has so quickly, it does kind of offer more opportunities for different opportunities for the actor.
Well, when it's in the hands of a complete visionary like Tim, you know, then I'm very happy to be a tube of paint and just hand myself over.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to say that the film is fantastic. It's
Thank
so
you.
Enjoyable. And you are
I
fantastic
love
in it.
It.
Yeah,
Thanks so
I,
much.
I would imagine so. And I thank you so much for your time. And Mr. Rickman, we're all huge fans of yours. And please come back to us sometime in the future.
Well, I'm an honorary geek, then.
You are.
Thank you.
You'll receive a special plaque pretty soon.
Yeah, I think I'd like that badge as honorary geek.
He's brought to life some of the most intriguing characters to ever grace the silver screen. He possesses a one-of-a-kind presence that can express irresistible charisma as effortlessly as icy cold menace. He is quite simply one of the most fascinating and hypnotic actors of the past 30-plus years and has been featured in some of our most groundbreaking, original, and exciting films. Films like Turkish Delight, The Hitcher, Nighthawks, Lady Hawk, Blind Fury, Batman Begins, Sin City, and of course his career-defining role in Ridley Scott's visionary epic, Blade Runner. He is Rutger Hauer, and there is no one else like him. His new autobiography titled All Those Moments, Stories of Heroes, Villains, Replicants, and Blade Runners, which has just been released in paperback, Mr. Hauer delivers his extraordinary life story with tremendously appealing candor, humor, and passion. Here you have a portrait of an artist who is constantly searching and curious, always looking deep into his characters for what is most interesting and truthful. The movie geeks are honored to welcome this remarkable artist to the show to discuss his life, his accomplishments, and those passions that continue to drive him after more than 35 years in the business, Mr. Rutger Hauer. Mr. Hauer, how are you?
Yes, hi, good. That sounds really wonderful. Thank you.
I was crazy about your book. I was just giddy reading it from cover to cover.
I'm happy to hear that. I really am. It's, you know, I wrote it for an audience, not for myself.
Right. And it was surprising right off the get-go because your parents were both actors. And unlike a lot of stories that you hear from the quote-unquote show business families, they didn't discourage you from entering the acting field, did they?
No. They were hoping that I would find a way to have a life, let's say, and it it didn't really matter to them what that was, but I didn't know what to do, so they said try the acting school after lots of different jobs, and then I did, and then I got through it. And then I got a, you know, I worked for theater for 4 years, and then I was discovered on camera, let's say.
Yeah, and your first major collaborator, I guess it would have been Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah.
And you both strike me as artists who kind of relish the chance to take risks and to see how far you can go with material. Tell me some other things that you guys have in common that made that collaboration sizzle like it did.
I think what, you know, it sounds funny, but the common sense, I think we also have in common, which makes you not float too much. Let's say the balloons that are also full of air, we tend to kind of hold on to the earth, both of us. And I did 5 films with him and one television series.
Right.
So we kind of got to know each other, and it was always really great to work with him.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the all-time great collaborations, in my opinion. Jerry, you actually had a question about the period of time.
Yeah, speaking
wicked
of...
sense of humor pretty much, I think, also comes in both of us. And
yeah.
But the sense of
apparent.
Reality...
That's apparent on screen, too.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, but speaking of, one of the films you collaborated with him, Soldier of Orange, and there are also several other films that you did in the World War II genre that you seem very comfortable, very at ease, because you have a very diverse range. You play, like, all characters across the whole spectrum. And I was just curious, what is it about that genre that attracts you?
Nothing, really.
Okay.
I people ask you what genre do you like, and I don't really have a genre that I like, and I have to be honest, I don't see a lot of films. I still work very much, and then when I'm off, I tend to not look at films for a bit, and so I kind of catch up later. I think everything is make believe, whatever genre you want to call it. The thriller, you know, I mean, The Hitcher, I thought was is one of my favorites as well. It's not that I like the genre so much, and also Blade Runner, it wasn't my genre, but I thought the script was wonderful, and it just, you know, these films just work out, and you never know if they do or if they will, you know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
It feels good when you make them, but you never quite know how far they will live, how long they will live. Very Blade Runner-ish.
Right, right.
How long will I live?
but I think it was probably Nighthawks was the one that brought you to America, right? To American audience?
No, not really. I mean, the thing that the film that brought me to America was, funny enough, was Soldier of Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And I got like a limited run in cities, and I did press for that, and that was my first. It was my second time in America, because Turkish Delight was also, that was what was it again? It was it was up for an Oscar nomination, and then there was like a whole thing because there was a lot of nudity in the film.
Mm.
that they called it X-rated and that you couldn't have a nomination for an X-rated film. That was a big, it was a big thing at the time. So that was my first time, and the second time was Soldier of Orange, and I got a good run and a good idea. And also that was a film that Ridley saw, Why He Wanted Me. So,
okay.
I mean, that film in many ways is sort of my bridge to the United States,
yeah.
or for that matter, an international career.
Right.
So I owe a lot to, you know, that moment, and to also to Paul Verhoeven, and to the, you know, the guy, the real guy, who I was performing a war hero. He just recently died, Erik Haseloff Ulsema, and we became the best of friends. And he died when he was 90. He just died a couple of months ago.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
It's interesting, though, how Nighthawks has kind of gained a cult status now, I find, as the years go by.
Yeah, because of terrorism. And that was sort of the first, I mean, in Europe, that we had quite a bit of terrorism in Germany mostly. And the whole thing in Munich was Santos, the guy, the character in Nighthawks was based on Santos, and Santos was also in charge of a raid of the Olympic Games in Munich.
Right.
But for the States, it was a new thing. And then, of course, you know, now, I mean, this film, I think I did this film in 80, so that's now, it's almost 30 years, and then, look where we are now. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Strange.
Yeah, it is. It is. But you talk about Nighthawks not being a pleasant shoot, and then a complete 180 seemed to be Blade Runner, because for the exact opposite reason. I think you're given free rein pretty much on your character in Blade Runner while the Nighthawks experience was very constrictive.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically not so much free rein, but Ridley was open to ideas, and if he felt they made some sense, then he would use them, and that's sort of where we found each other. I mean, you know, I don't want to be left alone. I would do very strange things. I need the director, but Ridley and I found each other on that film, and that was you know, after. You know, the Nighthawks film was a hard one, and that was such a relief, because I sort of was a bit dented in terms of my beliefs of American cinema making,
right,
and filmmaking. I went, wow, if it's that way, do I want to be here? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, big relief, and so nice that the film holds its own for so long. It's so amazing.
Yeah, and part of the big joy for me in reading your book was that it's clear that you're an actor with so many ideas when you come to the set, and when you explain,
yeah,
those ideas and how they came to fruition, that just made me so joyful to read that in the book.
If it wasn't for the internet, I wouldn't really trust myself to write all that down, and even that is still, let's say, a map of the ideas that I have. I can't write it all down, but some of it. But the internet has given me some trust and some faith that people understand what you do, and that's very nice. I never thought they would understand that unspoken language, and they seem to really get it well. So that's,
yeah,
very nice. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering when you craft a performance, how much of it is, do you rely on intellect, and how much on instinct?
I think, I don't know. It's a mix. It's really hard to judge from me. I follow, you know, the director and my instincts. I follow those lines. And then if the director is in it with me, then I can start, you know, doing little fantasies and having little outings with ideas, depending on, you know, what the parameters are. But most of it comes from just, you know, imagination. I think that's where the audience needs to go, so why would I not start there?
Yeah, and so much of it happens in the moment, too. And so it has such a quality that it's just alive on screen, I find, too.
Well, lovely, you know, lovely, lovely. I try, you know, and I, you know, how much certainty do you have as an actor? No, I don't believe you have a lot of that anyway. And I there are times that I think I'm taking a role and I think I can't do it. And that doesn't last very long because I get my senses back. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I don't have that certainty. I don't want to go the road that I went. So I try to rediscover, you know, characters if I feel that they are repetitive. I mean, if I play a bad guy, I have to have a good sense that I can do something with it,
yeah.
You know, that is worth doing.
Blade Runner is a movie that has survived and thrived so well over the years. Do you have a preference as to which one you prefer?
A preference for what? For which draft of Blade Runner, you mean? Yeah.
For which kind of Blade Runner that we think works the best?
The last one.
Really?
The last one is the one he wanted out first, and he was so right, and it's, you know, the differences are still not major, I don't think. The film always plays because it's so strong, but this one is really a final cut, and it, you know, and you feel it. It moves better, it's warmer, it's got a little more... It got a little more heart for all the characters, you know, especially for Harrison Ford's character, who, you know, I never cared for him that much. And then I was honestly outside of my role. Like, I didn't see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's, you know, it's a masterpiece, you know, and it's, you know, I know no qualms saying that. And it's because of everybody, and especially Ridley's mind. But let me say something before we, you know, be... I would have never written the book, let's say, you know, if I wouldn't have done it for charity. I thought it would be an interesting idea to write a nice book from the center of making movies, you know, and where I stand as I do them, and see if I can raise some funding for a charity for AIDS that I have since 2000, and I do small things for that. And it's really odd because in the publicity that I do for the book, I always tell people, and it never seems to survive for some reason. And I think if, you know, if people buy a book and they know it's that all the, you know, all the profits go to HIV and some, you know, a charity that I run and that I believe in.
Starfish.
It makes a difference, I would think, you know.
Yeah. Well, I actually, in my list of questions,
I just want to get that out of the way.
No, absolutely, and I think that's crucial because in my list of questions here, I wanted to focus on your organization. It's called Starfish, correct?
It's called the Starfish, the Rutger Hauer Starfish Association.
Okay. and all the proceeds from the book go to that organization, and actually. On the screen that our listeners are on right now, there's a clickable link. Click on the cover of your book. It will take them to Amazon where they can purchase it, and all the proceeds go to your foundation. So,
yes,
I think that's crucial.
You know, I fought for that because, you know, I wanted to have that on there. And they said, well, you know, they'll find it inside the book. And I said, well, can you not put it on the outside of the book? You know, all that stuff. Anyway,
yeah,
you only do this once.
Right.
So tell me what your foundation, what this funding goes towards.
Well, you know, I've decided after a couple of years of struggling and trying to be a hero in some, you know, godforsaken small island where AIDS is just, you know, incredibly present, let's say, in the Turks and Caicos Islands, I decided that there would be more result if I would be a little closer to the source. And so because I was, you know, I was mostly not there. So I decided to bring it to wherever I would be, I'll do something. And on that route, I've discovered some really interesting people that I can trust and that I can work with and do something good if I have, you know, if I have funding. And the other thing that I thought was, why don't I bring it back home to my own profession and see if I can find some filmmakers who will, you know, work with me on this? It doesn't, you know, just the idea, you know, a concert for AIDS. Why don't filmmakers do film for AIDS? And so I'm sort of doing that at the moment. And I started it last year. So I'm bringing it home to my own craft. So, you know, I'm closer to it and you know, we use our craft to get it out there. It's basically all about the same thing, awareness, and, you know, let's not forget, you know.
Absolutely.
And
the core
of the whole thing is that, you know, pregnant women and children, I'm trying to give them help. It doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter where it is. I'll do it if I can. I think I'm going to go to Romania next. And I was there a couple of years ago, twice. And one of the things I found was that there was a village, basically, sort of almost like a concentration camp, but a nicer setup for the kids, because they were orphans. Nobody cared for them, and because they did get medicine, they had to live somewhere. It was an Italian, Mino D'Amato was his name. He sort of was responsible for a whole village being built by Italians in Bucharest and Romania. Nobody stopped him because the politics, they couldn't stop him because they thought that was too painful, so they let him go. So illegally, he put a hospital in Bucharest, and then he put like a village for kids with HIV there, orphans. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going there. I'm going to try and get a pool together, because I remember, you know, how much they wanted to go for a swim, and the river is polluted, and the swimming pools don't allow them to swim because they think that's going to kill people. So that sort of thing is what I'm doing. And I do other things, you know. I'm hoping to get some documentaries going, you know, from filmmakers who I can send to China or whatever.
Well, I applaud
Made
you.
Made in China. Made in China, different brand. Yeah.
Excuse me, Mr. Howard, do you feel that you're also like battling a lot of ignorance about the...
Yeah,
AIDS?
No, sure.
It sounds like from what you said about Romania, it sounds like there's still a lot of ignorance about the truth about the disease.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to call it. You know, it just needs to be done. It needs to be done. And there's so much, you know, that you can do, even in the little things, you know, and that's all I'm doing. I'm doing things when I can, and I know where to find them, too.
Right.
I don't look at a city, you know, through you know, the glasses of bling. Or,
right.
You know, I take one look at a city, and I can see where the different routes are, and I'm going to go shopping. And I don't mean that in a nasty way.
Right. No,
I'm going to go shop. You know, get to know the places a bit. So
yeah.
I'm not just an actor who lives in a hotel and shoots a movie there.
Right.
Well, we have a link on our website here where they can purchase your book, and it's a fantastic fun read, and icing on the cake that the proceeds go to help your AIDS. So I think that's absolutely essential.
Okay.
Before you go, can I ask you about The Hitcher, because that's one of my favorite
films. You can. How long do we have?
We have as long as you want to give us, but I don't.
All right. Okay. Fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to overstep my boundaries because this is long distance. I know, but.
Never mind. Yeah, you'll live, I'm sure.
The Hitcher is absolutely one of my favorite films of that genre, just because it's so down and dirty and kind of relentless. Mm. And but I had a different kind of view of how you portrayed the character from when I read your book and read your take on it. I thought that you probably it was a role that didn't require you to find the humanity in it. But you had a very...
You're right.
Is that correct, or do you have a different take on that character?
Are you asking me if it was a role that can you be a little more precise, and I'll answer it precise?
Well, because a lot of times characters, when they play so-called villains, they search to find the humanity in the character, and I thought that this was a different kind of role.
Okay. In what way?
Well, it's an unstoppable force.
Are you saying you didn't feel the humanity?
I thought that the character represented an unstoppable force, and that's what he was.
Right.
The
force of what? I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah.
The force of what?
Like an unstoppable, like a Terminator almost, just an unstoppable killing machine.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to take that away from you. It sounds fine. I play every character as humane as I can come up with, and it doesn't matter, you know, what the character is. I play characters, I play people, basically.
Yeah.
And some people are really mean and others are not, you know. So I thought he was charming. I thought he was one of the most charming men I would meet on the road.
Okay, all right. Speaking of charming, can I ask you a question? I know I'd like to ask a question if you have the time.
Yeah, you're asking the questions.
Yes, I know. I just don't. We don't want to you know, keep you or anything. But I, speaking of monsters, or you know, you see the good, not the good, but you take the human element of each of your characters. What was it like playing Albert Speer in Inside the Third Reich? How did you approach that material?
Well, I approached it pretty much from, you know, he'd written a book, a 500-page book in prison while he was in prison for 25
right.
years. And I sort of took the stance, and I don't think it, as an actor, I don't think you should, you know, you just have to make it believable, whatever
right.
whatever the role is. But I thought, if the guy's in prison for 25 years, why would he lie?
Exactly.
So I based my, sort of my, let's say, sincerity or whatever you want to call it on that. But then, and then, of course, you know, 10 years later, they discover he really lied a lot in that book. So,
yeah.
So he fooled me, and there you go. But, you know, so you take the ingredients that you think make sense
mm-hmm.
for the moment, and you work with them and see if the director likes them, and then you take it from there. I'm afraid it's not a life-altering experience for me most of the time.
But
you know how actors sort of tend to go, oh, yes, it changed my life. but that doesn't really seem to work for me, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, but at the same time in your book, I mean, you're essentially reviewing your career, so you have to
moments.
Have some... Yeah, well, that's what I want to ask you about, the moments... What moments are you proudest of as an actor? Particular moments in a film where you say, "Oh yeah, that was gold for me."
Well, you know, that's sort of there are moments in some of my other films, like Legend of the Holy Drinker, I think is pretty mm-hmm. brilliant. There's a film, the short film I did called To Rome, that I think there's in the acting. But then also there's in the swordplay. I just love swordplay, you know, in Lady Hawk and in Blind Fury and
mm-hmm.
in a horse riding. You know, I love all that stuff. If I see an actor who rides a horse who plays with the sword as if he is really there, you know, I just like that. And I was the master of that for a while. Let's put it that way. And that sort of simple stuff that is physical almost. It's physical. Understanding. I really like that, and I'm, you know, am I proud of Lady Hawk? Yes, I am proud, but the most proud of, I am of the battle in the end, because I did all of it, and the same goes for Blind Fury. And I don't think there's any actor who will ever do that, and I can act a little bit here and there too. You know.
But,
no, you know, it's a good mix.
Well, for a while there, you know, because they talk about actors being emotional athletes, and you also used your physical athleticism as well for a good stretch of your career. That had to be fulfilling to have an opportunity to mix those two disciplines, I would think.
It is. If it works, it's great. You know, I mean, it's hard to explain it. If you get hired for a role, you shoot the movie. This is about Blind Fury. You shoot it in, where did we shot it? I mean, in Texas and in Nevada. And they finish, they edit the movie, and then they come back and go, can you come back and do a sword fight? Because, you know, the end of the film stinks, and we'd like to shoot that. And then you're in front of one of the best swordsmen in history for films, who's always had like a black cap on his face and never been seen on film. God, you know, his name escapes me right now. And he says, "You can do this. You can do this," and you have, you know, it's so wonderful. It's just so wonderful to work with these kind of people.
Yeah.
And the same goes for Horseman, and you know, and a lot of other people as well.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take any more of your time up. You've been so mm-hmm. generous to us.
Yeah.
And when you come back to the States, Mr. Howard, please
yeah.
give us a call. We'd love to hear from you again. You're one of our favorites.
Okay. I'm going to go to Cannes first tomorrow to see if I can kind of get some wind going on a project that I want to direct for. It's been on my mind for 2 years now.
Is this a feature project?
Yeah. There's another thing that I can urge you to take a look. which is, I am very proud of it because I've been working on it for 4 years now. It's a website. It's an online website for short films. I've got a great bunch of judges there, and it's for filmmakers around the world. We're asking them for their short films, and that's going to be the first festival in Milan in September. And it's worldwide. If the films are not in English, they have to subtitle them. That's what's unusual about it. And because I did that, the quality is so high that I can, you know, already I see great power in it, basically. And lots of fun, of course. And, you know, and filmmakers, you know, the new faces, we can see them there. The new faces of film.
Yeah.
Very.
And that website is rutgerhauer.org, correct?
No, that's my own website. This is called IC Films with IC, icfilms.org.
Okay.
You can find it inside my website, too. There's links there, but icfilms.org, and it's great fun. And, yeah, we got about 2,000 short films, and we've chosen about 120 now to run in September.
This seems like a really kind of fulfilling time in your life, because you're making your own stand and making your own difference towards AIDS. You teach acting. You have a short film competition.
They're all kind of things that give back pretty much. You know, I think I have a system down where they all come back to the same thing. I mean, on the acting part, I think I've got a Rutger Hauer Film Factory going every year, which is the same thing. We make 30 filmmakers sweat like dogs and make them shoot tons of movies. And the experience is life altering for them, because I have something that nobody else knows, and I know where it lives, and I can bring it to them, and they love it, and it's great, you know. So that's one thing. Then it's the short films. I'm trying to get a circle going that is a real network, not a fake one, in Europe, pretty much.
Well, Mr. Hauer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We admire your work so much, and please come back to us anytime in the future you'd like to.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Hauer.
Okay.
Bye-bye, darling.
Bye. Was nice talking to you.
You too, sir. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye. Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite. Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited. YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited.